Oh, good thing
everybody.
for
This week's Parsha is Parsha Shoftim, and the title class is Lady Diana and the Seatbelt. Tomorrow will be her 25th Yahrzeit.
That's crazy.
Yeah. A very special person, and who ended in a very tragic way. So let's, as they say, let us go to the videotape.
Documentary about Princess Diana, where we hear from her older sister and the questions she still has about the night Diana died 20 years ago. Adrian Banker here with that story. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning to you too, George. It's not often we hear from Diana's sister, but she and others in the family are commemorating her death, speaking candidly about their grief from 20 years ago. Often avoiding the spotlight, Princess Diana's eldest sister, Lady Sarah McCorkadale, shares openly about her torment the night of Diana's fatal car crash.
These 2 hours, the presenters on every news channel were saying, injured but expected to make a full recovery, and I have no idea why, but it made me so angry.
This morning, more from that rare interview and others in the royal family in the new BBC documentary, Diana, 7 days. Lady Sarah agonizing over one fateful question.
She was religious in putting on her seatbelt. Why didn't she put it on that night? I'll never know.
Diana's sister Sarah was definitely somebody that she would go to if she was struggling. Diana's family have never or very rarely spoken before about her. But I think for the 20th anniversary, they were very keen to, in the knowledge that lots of people will be coming out and talking about their sister, they wanted to have authoritative voices speak about her and who she was. And they wanted the right kind of voices and the right kind of narrative.
The documentary features Diana's equally famous sons, Prince Harry, who says, "I wonder every single day what it would be like having her around." And William, Duke of Cambridge, who remembers years of distress from being in the public eye.
We go looking for her, to talk to her, to play, to do whatever. She'd be crying. And when that was the case, it was to do with press. The damage for me was being a little boy, aged 8, 9, 10, whatever it was, wanting to protect your mother.
They've often paid tribute to her work, to her legacy, but for them to actually speak about how they felt about losing their mother was incredibly moving, and it's not something that we've ever heard before.
It was an intimate look at what those sons were going through. Diana certainly wouldn't have been proud of both of them, as they've carried on her philanthropy and graciousness. William and Harry have been commemorating her life over the past year, rededicating her grave, installing a garden. London celebrated her birthday. The anniversary of her death is this Thursday, August 31st. I looked back on some of the research. Her funeral is still one of the most highly watched events in television ever. Billions of people around the world loved her and tuned in that day. The sons really wanted to make sure that she was remembered and honored 20 years later.
Right, well, it certainly is moving to hear their thoughts and feelings about their mother, that they still, of course, think of her every single day.
Absolutely. And I think still people are in touch with who she is. I have friends that are traveling to London for this event.
And they have been doing such good work in her memory.
Absolutely.
Adrian, thanks very much.
Well, hey there, GMA fans.
Robert. All right. Okay, so very sad story, and so just to bring everybody up to date, just to refresh everybody's recollection, because it was 25 years ago. So August 31st, 1997, Diana died in a car crash in a tunnel in Paris. While the driver was, anybody remember, why were they driving very fast, going 80 plus miles an hour?
They were going against the paparazzi.
Exactly. They're being chased down by the paparazzi, because in the car was her companion. Anybody remember his name?
Prince Charles. The son of the shipping magnate?
Yes. Right? Dodi Fayed. And, and the driver. And apparently the driver was a little drunk, which of course did not help his reflexes, zipping through Paris. And the one guy who survived, Trevor, who was a bodyguard hired by Dodi's father, he survived. Unfortunately, nobody in the car was wearing a seatbelt. And as you heard, her older sister said, you know, she always wore a seatbelt. Why was that one night that she didn't wear the seatbelt? which of course is a very, very painful and disturbing, sad, you know, thought. So question one. So the NHTSA study of lives saved by vehicle technology found that between 1960 and 2012, that's 52 years, seatbelts saved more lives, which 329,715 to be exact, than all other vehicle technologies combined, including airbags, energy-absorbing steering assemblies, electronic stability control. In the instant you buckle up when you're driving or riding in the front seat of a car or truck, you cut your risk of a fatal injury in a car crash by how much percent? Yes.
50%.
Scott Shapiro, really? On the mic. Exactly right. 50%. You're wearing a seatbelt and you're in a serious crash. You've just increased your chance of survival by 50%. So the question, of course, is if Prince Diana was wearing a seatbelt that night, would she be alive today? There's the answer. Yeah. A good chance. Not for sure, but a very good chance. So now we get to the question of the night, which we're going to get into our partial course, is if seatbelts are so vital, why do some people, frequently young people, do not wear or consistently wear seatbelts? Why don't people wear seatbelts?
Honestly, I can't even tell you because it seems like it's insane that anybody would not wear a seatbelt.
But not everybody, you know, I don't know, 10-20% don't always wear a seatbelt, or maybe they're occasional seatbelt wearers.
They're restrictive, they're uncomfortable, I don't look cool, you know, any one of those, I guess.
Good. So you're on the right thing. There are certain rationalizations that you brought up. There are certain beliefs. So let's take anybody have some ideas? Put some on the board, as they say. Give me what are some of what's a classic thought? What are classic reasons that people give? You may hear this.
I have cat-like reflexes or something.
Right, in other words, that's very good. Denial. I'm an awesome driver. People who are not awesome of a driver, you know, they need to wear a seatbelt, but I am an awesome driver. Now, what is the assumption about that belief? What error is that person making? They might be Mario Andretti. They might be the best car driver in the world.
They're not taking into the account of others on the road.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, when a person gets into a car accident, they did nothing wrong. The other person turned into them. Or, you know, in other words, you can be a great driver, but people can crash into you. So it's got nothing to do with being an excellent driver is a good thing. But that's not the entire cause of car crashes. In fact, it may have not been your fault. But the truth is, once there's an impact on your car, all things in that car are moving at the same rate of that force. So you're going to be, you get the power, you're going to start going this way. So if you don't have anything restraining you equally in the opposite direction, you will go, you know, and keep on going, possibly into the windshield. So that would be bad. So another belief, there are a lot of beliefs that person has, like, you know, as you mentioned, Scott, you know, seatbelts are for dorks. You know what I mean? There's some sort of negative. Then there's also like
association with it. Yeah.
Yeah, like a goody two shoes that dorks put on seatbelts, but the cool people don't, right? Or you'll have the belief that the idea of car crashes and their mortality is a scary thought. You know, they repress it altogether. In order to seatbelt itself associates the issue of danger. So therefore if I don't engage with that, there's no problem. You know what I'm saying? Or I don't even want to think about it. All right? So they don't want to even think about the issue. Then there's another belief that you may have heard of. When it's my time, it's my time. Otherwise known as the belief of fatalism. In other words, that You know, whatever I do has, there's a pre, every person has a predetermined time, has a certain expiration date, which you do not know, like the bottle of milk. And there's nothing you can do to change it. So therefore, if it's my time to go, it's my time to go. So therefore, there's no point to do any kind of safety measure such as wearing a seatbelt. You'll hear that. I'm just giving you a, I'm giving you some of the top, some of the top rationalizations.
Rabbi, I was going to wait till the end because of what you said earlier, but now that you mentioned it that way, right, there's also that Gemara in Sukkah, right, and the case was, the story was, right, the fellow was safe, right, and then he ended up dying at the doorway to Lud, right, and then Hashem master planned that he'd die in that situation where he wouldn't have went there in the first place if not for the situation that told him he was going to die or that it was his time almost, or he had to go to that place, right? So in this case, you know, like a Diana or another situation, sometimes it's meant to be that a person's drawn to a certain location. That's where their death is supposed to happen.
So but you're bringing up an issue of a divine intervention. You know what I'm saying?
No, but I'm saying, but think about it. If Princess Diana would always wear her seatbelt, and in this one situation, when they're speeding, right, all of a sudden she's not wearing her seatbelt? I mean, obviously, we're mixing issues, but I'm just saying that you could also say that, you know, part that was all part of the master plan.
Okay, so but the basic rule is ein somcha al neis. We do not rely upon miracles, and if you do rely upon a miracle, you're not going to get a miracle. So the bottom line is that you have to do your hishtadlis to do everything safe. Doesn't mean that there are people who do wear their seatbelt and they do nothing wrong, and they also pass away in tragic accidents. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I actually know somebody who the miracle is that he didn't, thank God he wasn't wearing the seatbelt because he would have died if he wore it. And he said he flew through the front the windshield and he's survived.
Right.
But I think that's probably not ordinary. Like,
right.
I don't think that happens a lot.
Seatbelt, where it goes, especially if it's around the neck, we know that that neck piece and also like an airbag, a lot of dangerous stuff from that. Right. Also,
so
right?
So there's been a whole lot of studies about that. And the reality is that
statistics are in favor.
Nothing is perfect. Nothing is perfect. That's what you have to know. Nothing is perfect. And but all things being equal, it makes sense to make a thing. And all the is that we don't know, quote unquote, the master plan, but it doesn't mean that your situation is determined. In other words, does health and fitness help or will not? You know, look, it might be that you may be predetermined or predisposed to certain cancer. You have certain genetic predispositions, but if you eat right and exercise, it could also help you manage the situation. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just saying there's a belief that people have which are fatalists that therefore they don't do even the most basic things such as a seatbelt, that and they'll rationalize that. So I'm just giving, there are different beliefs that people have about this. You know, what other beliefs do people have that prevent them? I'm going for a short ride. It's not going to happen. You know what I mean? It's just the old,
I'm going around the corner. Yeah.
I'm just going for a short one, right? If I'm going for a long ride, I need to wear a seatbelt. If I'm going for a short ride, well, you know, I don't have to. My point being is there are all kinds of rationalizations that people have. And, and also is that I can decide when a belt is needed. I have a sense of the situation, what the danger factors is. You may hear people say that, and also a person says like, they don't want to wear a seatbelt because they don't want to accept the fact that in fact, we're not so in control of our lives. We can control ourselves, which is not so easy. And there are other people that involved. So, and then of course there's the people who say, well, seatbelts aren't really helpful. You know, they'll say that, well, there's one guy who wore a seatbelt and they died. Well, you're right. That's true. But out of you know, the millions and millions of people who are driving, billions actually, and wearing seatbelts, it saved hundreds of thousands of people. All right. So So that's okay. So now let's keep on going. What laws are effective increasing compliance?
Click under a ticket like that, like those.
Number one,
laws that you're accountable for.
Yeah, well, number one is Scott Shapiro. In 30 states, it's a primary offense, which means that if a police officer sees a person without a seatbelt on, they can pull you. That is enough to pull you over and give you a ticket. In the other 20 states, actually, except for one, in other 19 states, they can't pull you over for the seatbelt, but they can pull you over if you're speeding, and they see you don't have a seatbelt, they can give you two tickets. Okay.
Right.
There is one state in America where there is no law to wear a seatbelt. Does anybody know which state that is? You get a 150 chance.
Texas?
You would think Texas. That would be a top guess.
Hawaii?
Nope.
Somewhere in the Midwest. Gotta be.
New Hampshire. New Hampshire. What is the state of New Hampshire's motto?
Live and let live. Don't tread on me.
Live free or die. Right.
Who's don't tread on me? Okay.
And now, people hate these laws. They hate these laws. Because the bottom line is, under all these different things, is a person wants to be free. And they don't want to be restricted, as Scott mentioned a couple of minutes ago. And I want to be able to, and I want to choose when I want. I want to choose when I can wear a seatbelt or not. You know what I'm saying? They don't want to be able to be pulled over and have to pay a $100 ticket. Or now they have laws that they have to make the car themselves be reminders. Like, I have a car, which if I don't fasten the seatbelt, it won't move. It won't move.
What kind of car is it?
It is a Sonata. Hyundai Sonata.
Hyundai
Sonata. You're in the front seat and you do not put a seatbelt in, it's not moving. It will not go into reverse. It will not go into drive. And it will make a very annoying sound. A persistent beeping sound, plus, you know, so it's like, so, and then you just like, you're going to do it because like, I just can't take the noise and I do want to move out of my driveway. So for all those reasons, I'm going to put the seatbelt on because it will not work. Okay. So people find that highly annoying. People find it very infantilizing, like I'm a baby, you know what I mean? So people have a lot of, so they hate these laws, hate the laws. I'm an older guy. But I remember back in the 70s, okay? First of all, they didn't have the shoulder thing. They just had the lap, like you have in an airport. You just had the lap, lap belt. And people would, like, routinely cut them out. There was a time through the early 60s, there was a guy, Ralph Nader, wrote Unsafe at Any Speed, his famous book, where he basically pointed out that having cars with no seatbelts basically, you know, you're just killing tens of thousands of people per year unnecessarily, purely avoidable deaths, and that caused a very big revolution in car safety, but people were very against it. Like, you know, part of the American experience, if you go to movies, is get into your car. That's your space. You can eat in the car. You can play with music in the car. You can set the temperature you want. You can go where you want. You're free as a bird. You know what I mean? Like Tom Petty, because I'm free. I'm free falling. Right.
Falling.
Right. So people want to be free. You know what I mean? So there's so many songs that go about the freedom of driving away. There is a lot of resistance toward all these laws. Now people have gone many generations through sort of more of an acceptance. Okay, with this background, we can take an appreciation of our Parsha. This Parsha, Shoftim, which means literally judges, deals as Moshe is readying the Jewish people to enter in the land of Israel, land of Canaan, and they have to create all the governmental institutions, one of which is a king, the monarch, the Melech. Okay, but the Melech has a number of very interesting halachot. So we're going to go to the share screen. And I'm going to ask Amanda to read. Vavakasha, Amanda, Perek, Yudzayin, Vavakasha. Take it away. You're on mute, though, so that would be helpful.
When you come to the land that God your Lord has given you, so that you have occupied it and settled it, you will eventually say, we would like to appoint a king, just like all the nations around us. You must then appoint the king whom God, your Lord, shall choose. You must appoint a king from among your brethren. You may not appoint a foreigner who is not one of your brethren. Do you want to translate or should I keep going?
Well, so basically, it's a mitzvah. It seems it's a mitzvah to appoint a king.
And but it can't be someone from outside.
Has to be a Jew. And even they infer even a not a convert could be a king. Has to be a born Jew. Okay, keep on going.
The king, however, must not accumulate many horses, so as not to bring the people back to Egypt to get more horses. God has told you that you must never again return on that path. He also must not have many wives, so that they may not make his heart go astray. He shall likewise not accumulate very much silver and gold. And when the king is established on his royal throne, he must write a copy of this Torah as scroll edited by the Levitical priests. This scroll must always be with him, and he shall read from it all the days of his life. He will then learn to be in awe of God his Lord and carefully keep every word of his Torah and these rules. He will then also not begin to feel superior to his brethren, and he will not stray from the mandate to the right or to the left. He and his descendants will thus have a long reign in the midst of Israel.
Well done. Thank you. So the Melech, the king, has a number of special halachot. Number one is he's not allowed to have too many horses, you know, or beyond what he needs for the military need. That was the horse was the truck and tank of the ancient world, number one. Why? Because where was the horse epicenter, horse raising epicenter of the ancient world? Egypt. Bringing the Jews back to Egypt undermines the entire Torah. Two, he should not have too many wives, okay, because they'll make his heart go astray. And he may not accumulate very much gold and silver, in other words, through taxation, okay? And as a positive, he has this obligation to write his own Sefer Torah, in addition to the Sefer Torah that every Jew has to have, according to the Rambam at least, and he has to be with that all the time. So he has to have his own little Torah with him, and he has to learn from it. And the idea is to keep the recognition that he's not the true Melech. There's a Melech Malchei HaMelachim, the King of Kings. And so he should not become arrogant that he's uniquely special. So for $500 in the square, 500 points in the square, which king violated these commandments? Famous king. Which Jewish king, which king in Israel did not keep these mitzvot? And I'll give you a hint. He's a famous king.
King Divin?
Nope.
Ahasuerus?
Well, Ahasuerus is not Jewish, so he's not bound by these. He certainly did not keep any of these. He had tons of wives, tons of gold and silver, and tons of horses. Yes, he was. You see that the Torah wants to create a restraint. Ahasuerus is what the normal king would do, although he seems to be pretty excessive. But which Jewish king famously did not keep these mitzvot?
King Solomon, because then Kohelet
King
was
Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech.
Because everything was taken away.
Yes, Amanda, correct. Shlomo HaMelech.
I was going to ask for support. Can I give a hint, a clue?
Well, because Amanda got it. Thank you. Thank you, Amanda.
I just needed like thinking time. I'm like, well, what's left? Which kings are left?
Okay. So with that background, so as we know, the Tanakh, the book of Malachim, kings, depicts Shlomo's reign from chapter 3 onward. And there he talks about that he ultimately had like 300 wives and 600 concubines. He had nearly 1,000 wives. One. And he taxed the Jewish people a lot, which till they got, they were chafing under the high level of taxation. He built, of course, a beautiful Mikdash temple. And, of course, he had lots of horses. So he literally violated the three mitzvot. So we're going to, the Rambam, in his Sefer HaMitzvot, book of mitzvot that he wrote as a introductory work before the Mishnah Torah, at the end of the mitzvah, on the end of the mitzvah of not to have too many horses, he talks about King Solomon, Shlomo Melech. So without further ado, I'm going to pick on Amanda again.
Okay. At least I'm not on mute now. The reasons for these mitzvot, he must not have too many horses, he must not have too many wives, and he must not accumulate very much silver and gold as given in scripture. Since their reasons was not known, it became possible.
No, since their reason was known.
Was known. Yeah. Whoops. As
all right, so, well, hold on, what's the reason for too many horses? Let's review. What's the reason for too, you can't have the kings not to accumulate too many horses?
He would go back to Mitzrayim.
You bring the Jews back to the Mitzrayim. Number two? Well, what's the reason for too many wives?
He would not be like fate, like he would be distracted.
They would sway his heart.
Yeah.
Well, you see that basically what and how did it manifest? These women, many of them were converts, and toward the end of his reign, when he got older, they went back to idolatry and he didn't say anything. So they had impact on him. He got old. They influenced him, and he wasn't able to influence them. All right, go on. And he must not accumulate much gold and silver.
As is well known from the case of Shlomo, who nullified them. In spite of his exalted level of knowledge and wisdom and his being the beloved of God.
By his name, the Tanakh calls Shlomo has another name. Yedidya, which means beloved of God. Go on. So that means that he's a good guy. He's a good guy. Go on.
Our sages said that this is a lesson to the people, that if God would reveal the reasons for all the mitzvot, they would find ways to disobey them. If even one who was so great and so perfect, for example, Shlomo, could make the mistake of thinking that he could do forbidden acts and avoid the underlying reason for the prohibition, how much more so than the more of the weak-minded masses? Certainly, if they knew the reasons for the mitzvot, they would disregard them by saying, this was prohibited, and this was commanded only for such and such a reason. I can avoid the reason for which the commandment was given and ignore the mitzvah itself. Well, people do that today. In such a way, the entire Torah could be nullified, and God could therefore conceal their rationale.
God therefore concealed the rationale.
Yeah.
Go on.
Therefore, there's not a single mitzvah, however, that does not have a reason and a purpose. The majority of these causes and reasons, though, cannot be grasped or understood by the masses. But regarding them, all the prophet says, the commandments of God are straight. They make the heart rejoice. And I ask that God, in his kindness, help me fulfill everything that he has commanded in these mitzvot, and to keep me far away from everything he has prohibited in them.
Okay. So the Rambam, so why did Shlomo HaMelech rationalize getting too much gold and silver, getting too many wives, and getting too many horses? What was his rationalization? What was his basic rationalization?
He was old, like he.
Well, no, but he did it when he was. He'd start doing it when he was young, when he was a young king.
He wanted to be a man of the people.
I mean, he was a man of the people. Why did you have to have lots of? What's the reason that what is the basic rationale that the Torah gives not to do these things? In addition, one is to go down to Egypt. What did Shlomo feel that he had when he made him different and special? What is Shlomo HaMelech's famous signature quality? What is King Solomon known for?
Being rich.
Nope. Only since I said it before, being the wisest of the wise.
The wisest man of the world. He was the wise man of that time. Why wisest man? So he was so wise that he's not going to be affected by having too many wives. He's not going to be affected by having too much gold. He's not going to be affected by having all the things. He's going to remain humble. He's going to remain grounded. He's not going to be affected. And what happened? He was affected. Because when it comes to a person's, you do not know the depth of our own personal desires. And we make rationalizations. Okay? So Reish Lakish has a famous line. This is the one, Reish Lakish is a famous Amora. He says, a person commits a transgression only if the spirit of folly, which the Hebrew is Ruach Shtut, the spirit of stupidity, enters him. King Solomon great wisdom not help him? What's a ruach shtus, a spirit of folly?
I think because he was human, you know what I mean? All the other kings of the time had this great gold and the great horses, and he had an ego. He was a tzaddik in many ways, but he's human. This is what makes him human.
So Reish Lakish is saying, but part of humanity, there's a part of what you're calling humanity, which is correct, which makes a person what he's calling the ruach shtus, a spirit of folly. Now shtut, stupidity. There's a certain kind of spirit when a person sort of like in a state of mind that a person gets into that allows them to be susceptible to making mistakes and ultimately sinning. Okay? So the best example is, go back to the example we have the car. I'm in a rush. I don't need to wear a seatbelt. Right, you know what I mean? You're just like not in the mood when a person's like in like a little bit of a crazy mood, and therefore they make certain decisions. Okay, once they get into sort of like into a very emotional state, that's when a person's susceptible to making bad decisions. So as Amanda pointed out. When you are what people don't recognize, when you are identified as the king of Israel and everybody's standing up for you and you have tremendous power over the entire nation, power corrupts. So the terrorists tried to create all these counterbalances. Number one, they made all the rules. You can't have too much gold. You can't have too many wives. You can't have too much horses. And you got to walk around with a little safe tower. And you got to learn from it. Why? To recognize that you're not... You are the king because you're working for the king. You're not the king. You're working for the king. But as Amanda pointed out, Nora's, he's human. So he got carried, what we call ruchstus, when we say you get carried away. You get into an emotional zone where you're not thinking so clearly, so straightly, so consistently. And that's when you're susceptible to making some bad decisions. That's what Reish Lakish is calling the ruchstus. It's in that emotional zone. Saying, and I don't feel like doing this. You just feel like a very, you're just very emotional. Okay. And that's when you think, all right, Chaim, raising his hand.
So why do we have to go as far to push it to the emotional part? Why can't you go into what you said before, right? You have to twist it faulty thinking, right? So you're so wise, right? You don't have to worry, right? Just like the person who's driving. Right, a short distance. No, right. I don't have to worry about my seatbelt because it's not about emotional state. It's just intellectual and delusional thinking as far as responsibility.
But ruach shtus is when a person doesn't mean the person's not thinking. It's when you're in that emotional state to crank out all the rationalizations, which is, I'm a good driver. These things don't work. Only dorks wear them. when it's my time, it's my time. All the rationalizations of the kingdom, that's when you start cranking them out. When you're just like, you don't, the bottom line is, I don't want to be restricted. And these are the reasons that are justifying, but you got to get into that Ruach Shkus zone to make a bad decision. So Shlomo Melech is similar to the non-seatbelt wearer. In other words, I don't have to follow the rules. The rules don't apply to me. In other words, the rules apply to those people who are dorks, who are not as good as a driver, who are not as careful. But Shlomo says, I'm the wisest of all men. And that wasn't just an empty boast. Literally, the Tanakh says he's the wisest of all men. But every man's a genius when it comes to self-deception. Does not mean that you cannot deceive yourself. And that's why. So what does the Rambam say? Why does the Torah not reveal all the reasons of the mitzvot? Rambam says they have reasons. Because if the Torah openly stated the reasons, people would say, well, I can avoid the problem that the Torah is trying to avoid by another way. So I don't have to be restricted. You know, whatever the reason given, you know, I can have the BLT, the bacon lettuce cheeseburger. You know, because there are certain reasons that I wanted to do that. So the Torah, in general, does not openly state the reasons. Why, says the Rambam? Because you're going to fall into the King Solomon trap, which is you're going to rationalize, saying that you're somehow different than everybody else. The rules do not apply to me, and therefore you don't follow them. And the irony is, King Solomon's whole life is that everything that the Torah said you have to avoid, King Solomon thought that it wouldn't be a problem for him. Ultimately, it did become a problem for him. The wives did affect him, and had a disastrous effect. It split the kingdom into two, into the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes versus the 2 tribes. So it was a calamitous experience. So what techniques allow a person to avoid getting to the Ruach Shkus zone?
Good habits.
So number one is good habits. Yes, 100%. In other words, let's say, going back to the seatbelt. In other words, as Scott says, you just get in the car, you put the seatbelt. That's just, it becomes like, you're not even thinking about it. It's like an automatic thing. It's like how you brush your teeth. You know, that's it. You walk into the bathroom in the morning, you're brushing your teeth. You're not thinking about, well, what is the best thing that oral hygiene demands of me? Should I or should I not do brush teeth? Maybe just a little bit of mouthwash. Maybe just a little bit of floss. You just get into the good habits. Get into the car, you brush your teeth. Wake up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you know, you seatbelt, brush your teeth. Good habits is a very good thing. And also, analyzing our own behavior. In other words, if we make mistakes, which we're going to make mistakes, looking back at the end of the day and thinking, well, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? And how can I improve? Chaim, you still have your hand up. Do you have an additional question?
No, sorry.
Okay. All right. So, all right. Yeah, I want to get some scenarios to flesh this out in a little more tangible way. Here we go. Dan MGR is going out with Atara. Atara is an FFB. That means from birth. And is more observant than he is. Stan really likes Atara a lot. Atara wants to keep the laws of being Shomer Negiah and the laws of Yichud. Shomer Negiah means there's no affectionate touch. Yichud means not being alone where sexuality could occur. Having sex could occur. Like being alone in a room, locked. Stan has never been in such a relationship. Stan feels that he does not need these laws, and he can control the situation on his own without regulation. What can seatbelt laws, and Shlomo Melech teach Stan? Good. Anybody want to weigh in on that? What is Stan struggling with?
Well, Stan is struggling with what most men struggle with.
Not just men. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. But go on.
There's your logical brain, and it's being recorded, so I won't say what the other brain is. And I just feel like Stan is saying right now, but in the heat of the moment, he's not going to be able to use his logical brain. He's going to resort back to his
baser instincts.
Right, his basic instincts. Amanda, excellent. In other words, there are laws because basically in areas which are very difficult to control, which is sexuality, the Torah basically approaches not to get is to basically sort of avoid circumstances where it's going to be next to impossible to control yourself. If a girlfriend and boyfriend are in a hotel room and the door is locked, you know, the outcome is not going to go well from the perspective of the Torah's ideal that sexuality should be reserved for marriage. So therefore, the approach is there's a statement in the Talmud that says "Ein apotropos la'arayos." One cannot be their own guardian when it comes to sexual immorality. In other words, the best approach is basically not being in the circumstance, because you're going to be in the circumstance, not because you're a bad person, but all people are sexual beings, so you're not going to be able to navigate that. So therefore, the Torah basically, said you can't even start the process. You can't affectionately touch people. You can't be alone in intimate settings, because basically, it's not going to, even though with the best of intentions, because the person that you are now in the, what they call in the cold state, is not the same person that you'll be when you're in the hot state. So we have this, so the Torah has rules, even if we think that we don't need them. King Solomon thought that he didn't need them either. Now, the truth is he was doing really good when he was young. The problem was, he didn't really understand that the way I feel now as a young, vibrant, bright, capable person is how I'm going to feel when I'm older. After decades of working as a king, run down, exhausted, physically, and when you're an older person, you're literally not the same person. So he didn't really think that one through. In other words, he was smart, but not smart enough. So the Torah gives us laws, both mitzvot, positive and negative, for our benefit, and does not give us the pressure to try to figure out what the best thing to do in every circumstance, because we're not very good at self-regulating. We have to have good habits, good laws, follow them, you'll get good outcomes. Let's keep on going. Nancy just received a new job and a higher salary, yet she cannot cover the very large credit card bill. Apparently, she had a very expensive and fun summer. Her brother Barry suggests that she fills out this easy-to-use budget app so she can regain control of her finances. Nancy is resistant. I don't need to record all these transactions. It won't make a difference. What can the seatbelt law and Shlomo Melech teach Nancy? What is the Ruach Shtus that Nancy is under?
She's a bit of a shopper.
Getting into a habit.
But what is... There's nothing wrong with being a shopper. Nor her brother Barry did not say, don't be a shopper.
Getting into a habit of writing down what you're purchasing keep track of it.
Why?
So you can be aware of how much of an idiot you're being from month to month.
Right, so therefore you figure out, because then you can, then what you're doing is bringing under the spirit of your mind. In other words, what are your financial goals for the year? What is important to you? What must you spend? What are the optional? And if you get into a very bad financial situation and you can't pay your rent, well then, whatever joy those particular purchases did was not more than being in default of your rent. So the bottom line is, but a person wants, the Ruach Shtus is that feeling of limitless unrestraint. I don't have to watch. I don't have to live in a budget. But the bottom line is, if you want to achieve certain financial goals, those are natural laws that will work. And if you want to believe you can live without restraint and have good outcome, that's not how Hashem created the world. So if you can live in a free spending kind of way, spending money, as you want, whenever you want, without thinking through the consequences, then you're going to end up in, like most Americans, in profound, large credit card debt, et cetera. So the rules of good finance or the terror rules are there because we're not very good at self-restraint all the time, especially when we get into a Ruhestut, in a sort of emotional zone. Like, as Amanda pointed out, you go into the store and you see that article of clothing that you just, that will just complete your outfit, complete your everything. Or you see that new phone, or you see that, you know, Amazon makes it even 50,000 times harder. I mean, right now where you're sitting, whatever desire you have in an object that you want can be delivered to your front door within 2 days. And it'll take you how long to buy that? 45 seconds. Okay. So Amazon is like, you know, Amazon is like, you know, heroin, you know, for shopaholics. I mean, it's just, you know, now it's very convenient. I'm a Prime member, obviously, because that's the way to go. Anyway, but I'm saying just to record the transactions will make ultimately will be a strategy for success that'll bring long-term happiness. Here's another example. Barry MGEar enjoys a good class. Barry likes to learn. Barry thinking about signing up for the MG Fellowship. A part of it is thinking that he'll just go to class with what that are offered, so he doesn't have to be tied down. What can the seatbelt law shall milk teach Barry?
Where have I heard this before?
This is always a struggle every year. This is our 15th year of the fellowship.
First off, I got the email. I am going to sign up.
It's a commitment. What does the commitment mean? What's the problem? So why does the person want to make the commitment?
It's like you're writing it down. Like it's a formal like declaration. Like, you know, that you're going to show up, you know, once a week to study Torah.
So what is Barry's struggle, internal struggle? Does Barry like to learn Torah? When he goes to a class, does he have a good time?
He doesn't want to be like, you know, forced to do it or tied down.
Right. Tied, or is a person wants to be free. They don't want to have any kind of commitments. But the truth is, the only successful life, the only way that you can achieve your goals is with discipline. And discipline requires commitment. But a person doesn't want to, if you want to have safety, you got to commit to the seatbelt. You want to have financial success, you got to have, you know, you got to have certain budgetary rules in your household. You want to have health and well-being, you have to have a commitment to working out, eating properly. It's all the same thing. And there's a tremendous part of us that doesn't want to do that. And that's why the Torah did not write down all the reasons, because King Solomon, further part of this week's Parsha, where it says the reasons, Shlomo Melch, the wise of all men, rationalized out of it. And exactly what would happen happened. And we're not on the level. So basically everybody else, we'd rationalize away all the Torah. And the Torah's goals and aspirations for us would not be met. So that's really the idea. So the Torah has reasons. They're not generally easily accessible. It requires work and study. But even when we come up with a great reason for a mitzvah, we still have to keep it because we don't know if that's the reason. We just know that that's the reason. And it might be, first of all, it might be, there may be more than one reason. Okay? It could be multiple reasons. So the point here is that going back into, just to summarize our message in class tonight, we started off recognizing and paying tribute to Lady Diana, you know, Princess Diana, Lady Diana, who, you know, tragically, due to her tremendous fame, you know, got chased down by the crazy paparazzi. And in a moment of, we don't know why, her sister to this very day agonized the fact that she used the word religious about using the seatbelt. But whatever reason, that night, it was late, whatever the thing was, tragically, and it was a big tragedy, she didn't put the seatbelt on. There are now people who are not so religious about the seatbelt because they have all these rationalizations, fatalistic reasons, I'm a great driver, only dorks do it, I know when there's risk or not, all these different rationalizations. And the bottom line is the rules are helpful to deal with what Reish Lakish says, the Ruach Shtus, of thinking that we can get what we call magical thinking in psychology. In other words, we'll get the outcome without putting the work, without putting the commitment, without putting in the discipline. It does not work that way. And the Rambam brings the example of King Solomon himself, that he rationalized the mitzvah applied to him as the king, which unfortunately the outcome that the Torah warned about actually occurred to him, to tremendous national effect, split the kingdom in two. And that's why the Torah does not, in general, give the reasons of the mitzvah. And we've applied that, that people have to deal with it. And it is a struggle. And by the way, it's not easy. It's not easy. I'm not minimizing it. But the benefit of committing, as you said before, the habit, that's, by the way, this is another example or manifestation of the atomic habit. In other words, the way to avoid is to make these rules into small little bite-sized things. Like, I'm not going to say I'm going to exercise for 30 minutes. I'm going to put my clothes on and I'm going to step outside and I'm going to do 2 minutes of exercise. In generally, if you're dressed to exercise and you already got your sneakers on, you're not going to just do 2 minutes. But you said just enough that right habits are going to get you over the resistance, and you're going to be able to follow through. So
I guess what's also to point out about the fellowship, I mean, I only did it for like 1 year or 2 years, but you have a chevra that you do it with. So then, like, if you don't show up, then you get a text from like Anna and Stephanie. Are you alive? Like, what are you doing? So I think it's also nice to learn with the same people each week.
It's motivation, yeah.
Right. So obviously you want to create, we purposely do that. Then we'll serve food and all the kinds of things. But it's overcoming that desire that I want to be not tied down. I don't want to have any commitments, but I want to somehow get all the benefits. It does not work that way. It doesn't work in our learning life, in our spiritual life, in our financial life, in our health and well-being. And sometimes the Torah gives a great feat by not telling us to do this rule. This is what Hashem asks us to do, and that's it, because otherwise we're going to weasel out a way not to do it. And it will not end well, as King Solomon's story tells us. All right, guys, a little taste of the Parsha. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you so much.
All the best.
Thanks, Rabbi. Bye. Bye.